Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources. Or check out all the original writing on our site at subchina.com. We've got reported stories, editorials, regular columns, as well as a growing library of videos and, of course, podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim people in China's Xinjiang region to China's ambitious efforts to eliminate poverty. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's been an eventful couple of weeks for those of us concerned about the future of U.S.-China climate cooperation. Indeed, for any of us who are concerned about global warming and the future of the damn planet. Last week, President Biden's special envoy on climate, John Kerry, traveled to China where he met with his counterpart, Xie Zhenhua, in Shanghai. The two sides put out a joint statement that might not have contained anything earth-shattering, but that, given the state of the relationship overall, produced shivers of pleasure in me. Not gonna lie, it was like a cool drink of water to a man dying of thirst. At the Boao Forum on Tuesday, while Chinese President Xi Jinping didn't make any specific commitments on carbon emissions reductions, he did use words like green and sustainable many, many, many times in his speech. That speech captured the particular challenge, I think, that we were talking about today, centering, as it did, both on the urgent need for, on the one hand, addressing climate change, and on China's increasingly assertive, let's call it, refusal, on the other, to acquiesce to an international order that is totally dominated by a hegemonic United States. So, as we record this episode, the Leaders' Summit on Climate, a virtual summit hosted by the U.S., is in its second day. Xi Jinping is also taking part in that summit, of course, and in remarks on the first day, which was yesterday, pledged to strictly limit increases in coal consumption over the period of the current five-year plan, while reiterating a pledge made to the UN General Assembly last year to achieve carbon neutrality by 2060. So joining me to discuss the fate of Sino-American climate cooperation are two leading experts on the subject. Let me first introduce Angel Xu, who recently joined the faculty here in Chapel Hill at the University of North Carolina as assistant professor in the Public Policy Department and Energy, Environment, and Ecology program. She is the founder and director of the Data-Driven EnviroPolicy Lab, an interdisciplinary research group that innovates and applies quantitative approaches to pressing environmental issues. Her research focuses on the intersection of science and policy, the use of data-driven approaches to environmental sustainability, particularly in climate change and energy, urbanization, and air quality. She joins us on Cynica for the first time. Welcome, Angel. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much, Kaiser, for having me.
It's weird that, you know, I've seen you in Davos, I've seen you in New York, I've seen you in Dalian and in Tianjin. We keep running into each other everywhere but the town that we both live in.
That's right. But hopefully once COVID passes, we could meet in person.
I've got my shots, so
yeah, me too. I'm fully vaccinated.
All right.
So yeah, let's get together.
We'll make a date. All right, happily, and we can talk about your real estate woes here.
Right.
Okay, also joining us is an old friend of the show, Alex Wong. Alex is professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, and he's a leading expert on environmental law and the law and politics of China. He was also a rock guitarist in the city of Wuhan back in the early 90s. We have that in common, too. Alex was a senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC, based in Beijing, and the founding director of the NRDC's China Environmental Law and Governance Project. Aside from being former rock musician like me, I don't have this in common with you, but you're best known probably as having been Jeremy Goldhorn's former landlord in
that
Beijing.
That is true. That is a weird connection we have.
Yeah, it is. Alex, welcome back, man. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Kaiser.
Okay, so let's jump right in and start with recent events, especially Kerry's mission to China, the joint statement that came out of that, and maybe what we've heard so far from the Leaders' Summit on Climate from both Joe Biden and from Xi Jinping. Angel, I want to get your sense first of what came of this meeting between John Kerry and Xie Zhenhua. Maybe first, before we do that, let's give people an idea of the two principals here. I think we're all familiar with who John Kerry is. I think many of our listeners know who Xie Zhenhua is. But let's talk about Xie and his relative stature in China, some of the salient biographical information on him. Angel, do you want to do that? I mean, if you don't know his bio as well, we can throw that to Alex. But
no, I'd be happy to. Yeah, Xie Zhenhua is somewhat the grandfather of China's climate policy. And so he's been a just godlike figure when it comes to formulating China's climate policy and being the lead negotiator for the Chinese negotiating team at many of these critical summits. And so he just is really well known both within China and also globally, and was really instrumental in shepherding China's climate policy from its very early days, where China very much played a defensive player in some of these negotiations, to where we see them now, which is really stepping forward and becoming a global leader on climate change. And so he had basically hopped into retirement. So he was leading a research institute at Tsinghua, which is what a lot of former diplomats and public figures go to do after they retire. And so he was sitting comfortably in retirement until he got the tap on the shoulder to come back and become reinstated as China's climate envoy. And so I think that really signals the importance that China is placing on climate change, and also to try to reinvigorate the relationship with the United States, because Minister Xie Zhenhua has a historic friendly relationship with John Kerry, and that was really instrumental in cementing the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and China in the lead up to the Paris Agreement. And so it was largely considered that the U.S.-China bilateral relationship on climate was fundamental to securing global consensus on the Paris Accord.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have Xie Zhenhua back into that position, I think was probably a breath of fresh air for John Kerry and the Americans, and saying, okay, well, they're open to having us reengage on this issue and to reestablish this really critical relationship. So that's kind of where I see the relationship. But yeah, Xie Zhenhua is always a really friendly face to see at negotiations. I mean, I think I've run into him at every climate conference that I've been to, and he's just really approachable and got a great smile, just a wonderful warmth. And unlike some of the other Chinese negotiators, he's not like in the trenches in the negotiating rooms, like drafting the deal. I mean, he's really the figurehead of the Chinese delegation. And so he's often sitting in the room and listening to Chinese scientists present the latest research on China's emissions trading scheme or China's thinking on green cities. And so he's just one of these figures that I think has just become so symbolic of China's climate policy. It's kind of hard to think about these critical times without him at the helm. And so I don't know if Alex has a different viewpoint, but yeah, I mean, I think definitely having him back in the driver's seat is a welcome return.
Yeah, fantastic. Hey, but I just wanted to stay with you for a second here, Angel. What did you think of the joint communique that came out?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, there wasn't really anything earth-shattering that came out of that communication. I think the main point is the fact
that we don't want earth-shattering; we want earth-healing.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, exactly. Earth-healing types of comments. I think the most important piece was for John Kerry to come into these conversations with humility and recognizing that a lot of trust was lost the last 4 years with not having the United States engaged at an international level, with President Trump withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement and reversing a lot of the critical pieces of the U.S.'s climate policy. And so I think what was really important is just in the spirit of reestablishing those connections and this really important relationship.
And then, Alex, what about you? What did you think? Was there an expectation that there would be maybe more aggressive targets announced? Or is there anything that you were hoping for in the joint statement that you didn't hear?
Yeah, I think, thanks for that question. I wanted to add a little bit something on Xie, just to remind us that, like many Chinese officials, he's been in this game for a really long time. He was formerly the head of the Environmental Agency, dating back to the late 90s, and people might recall that he had to resign after a chemical spill around 2005, if I recall correctly.
In Jilin or something.
Yeah, and then he came back into the picture as vice chairman at NDRC, the Economic Planning Agency, and then became this leader in climate negotiations, and is, by all accounts, a very talented and very effective figure. But on the
NDRC, not to be confused with NRDC.
That's right. Yeah. But on the joint statement, I think I don't think anyone expected a lot to come out of the joint statement, and I think what it is an initial engagement by two very senior and sophisticated diplomats who have known each other for a long time. And there had been a lot of tough talk from the governments in the months prior to that. And this was a nice way to just sort of say, on this particular issue, let's try to find ways to work together. And, the language is pretty soft and it's about continuing discussions and things like that. But it had signals that suggest that there might be other things to come. So it's, for example, how much will the countries raise their ambition in the run-up to Glasgow, all right? There's language suggesting that they're both attempting to enhance action in this decade, for example, before 2030. Mm-hmm. And there's also language about working together to maximize the transition from fossil fuels to clean tech in developing countries. So that's
right.
Those are things that we people all care about, but just initial, kind of soft language, but, not bad, but nothing earth shattering. Right.
We'll dig into both of those issues, how to sort of nudge developing countries, what the United States and China can do to move them toward, less carbon intensive development, and the other issues that you brought up. But I want to ask first about the Leaders' Summit on Climate. And what you thought of that. The U.S. has now committed itself to what I think is a very ambitious target, halving emissions by 2030 from 2005 levels. Give us a sense of how ambitious or aggressive that goal actually is. I don't think that, what's the baseline? What was the earlier target and where have we come from there?
So if we look at the science of climate change, and in particular, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 2018 report on 1.5 degrees Celsius. So before the IPCC came out with this report, there wasn't really a sense of what it would take to hit this 1.5 degrees Celsius target. The models were not fully developed yet. And so negotiators put this aspirational goal into the Paris Agreement in 2015 without having the science and the modeling to actually know what that would entail from countries.
Right.
And so it was really critical for science to play a little bit of catch up and to say, okay, this is what's really needed. And so once that report came out, the goalpost became really clear.
Right.
We have to decarbonize. We have to reach net zero emissions by 2050. In order to get that, we have to have global emissions by 2030. And so for the U.S. to align the NDC with those goalposts, I think is absolutely critical because it shows that we're actually aligning our commitments with the science for what we need, what needs to happen globally in order to get to that net zero target. So I think that's really critical.
The IPCC report came out in what year? What
in
was
2018, yeah. So
2018,
in September,
right. So
of 2018.
That wouldn't have happened in between 2018 and 2020, obviously. Right.
Right. But, yeah, exactly.
So it's basically what we've done is we're basically taking on board what the IPCC report said. It's got to be not 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees, and we've got to have carbon emissions by 2030.
Exactly. And so That's that really critical midterm target to get us to net zero emissions by 2050. And so now more than 127 national governments around the world have also committed to net zero targets. And so that's really encouraging because we need every country around the world, whether they're developed or developing, to align their commitments with those goals if we want to globally achieve decarbonization and avoid 1.5 degrees Celsius of global temperature rise. So I think from that perspective, it was really encouraging, especially observing and watching climate policy the last decade or so, and there hasn't really been a lot of traction on the U.S. side to actually do something like that. So I was really excited and impressed that President Biden went ahead and made that commitment of 50 to 52% reduction from 2005 levels. And of course, you're going to get critics that come out and say, oh, but the Europeans are all adopting a 1990 baseline. And if the U.S. does that, then the target looks less ambitious because it's only a 43% reduction from 1990 right. levels. And so I think we can quibble and we can go back and forth and say whether or not it's ambitious or unambitious. But I think at this point, at least for somebody who's been following climate policy and studying it for such a long time, I think that having something that is a clear signal and a clear policy goal in place, I think that's really momentous. And so I was really encouraged by that.
So Alex, Xi Jinping also gave a speech yesterday. Did he have anything that you think matched in terms of its ambition, what President Biden laid out?
Yeah, so everyone's been evaluating what he said yesterday. So he talked about, you know, you mentioned the target, the language earlier on, and he talked about strictly controlling coal and
but no numbers around it, right?
And a phase down in the 15th five-year plan. So nothing. No numbers, but certainly as a political signal. On the positive side, people have said, well, look, this is first time at this level that we have Xi Jinping talking about phasing down coal. So that's an important signal. But the other way to look at it is, look, if you already had this peaking target, and for China to meet that peaking target, inevitably this would have to happen on coal. So a lot of the debate is about how aggressive these targets are. And the advocates, environmental advocates, would like to see all of this accelerated. And people believe that these things can be accelerated, for example, peaking by 2025, you know, stopping coal now and starting to reduce coal now. These sorts of things are what is being debated. I think the other aspect of what she said yesterday, you know, there's the issue of what China's doing on the substance of climate action. And there's also the element of kind of, I guess, international reputation or image making and the right. diplomatic side of this, right? And so there's clearly an effort by the U.S. and China to try to jockey for the mantle of leadership, right? And so the leader summit is obviously an attempt by the U.S. to reassert its leadership on the stage. And then there's the decision on China's side is, you know, how much do they sort of play into that sort of dynamic, right? And there are signs that China has wanted to not make their biggest announcements at a U.S.-led party, in a sense, right? So
yeah,
you saw last year with the carbon neutrality announcement in September, you know, that was, you know, the timing of that is probably no accident, right? You sort of know that what Biden's climate actions are likely to be. And so they sort of controlled the agenda and really reshaped the global discussions on climate change by making that announcement. And the sense is at this meeting, they probably don't want to use this platform as the one to make another major announcement. So that's maybe one, I would say it's an optimistic take on it, because maybe it means that at COP26 or somewhere later, something more ambitious will come. But that sure. remains to be seen.
Maybe China will host its own climate leaders summit. And Angel, you talked yesterday on a panel that the National Committee put on about the significance of Xi's announcements at the UN General Assembly last year. The context is that you were saying that up until, you know, quite recently, I've talked about this with Alex as well, the Chinese position was still that developed countries, you know, which are responsible for the majority of extant greenhouse gas, it stays in the atmosphere for 30 years, you know, despite the fact that China is now the biggest emitter. They should still take the lead and they should shoulder the real burden. And that's why, you know, the peak carbon and carbon neutral goals were pretty surprising and maybe, you know, delighting. Was this, though, this is my question to you, was this the result, ironically, of the U.S. abdication of leadership on climate during the Trump years? Was this China kind of wrestling for that mantle? And I mean, if so, I mean, Christ, this is the kind of arm wrestling that I applaud, right? I mean, this is what we want.
Yeah,
this is the kind of competition.
Yeah, I don't know if during the last 4 years, China was really wrestling for the mantle of leadership on global climate.
It just kind of fell into its lap.
It kind of fell, exactly. I think that there was a main pillar that the U.S. was resting on in terms of climate leadership, and then it fell into China unwillingly. And so, I mean, yeah, China, it's been really interesting watching them evolve in global climate change governance, because they certainly have held steadfastly to this idea of common but differentiated responsibilities that's right. enshrined in the UN Framework Paris. Convention on Climate yeah. Change, right, and the Paris Agreement and its predecessor, the Kyoto Protocol, which still is the only legally binding treaty on climate change. And
which the United States still never signed. Right?
That's right, exactly. And China did. And so they've always said, developed countries, it's their historic responsibility, and they should be the ones taking the lead on climate change. We have a right to develop. We still have a GDP per capita of less than $9,000 per person. We have huge poverty problems that we still need to resolve. We need to lift millions of people out of abject poverty. And so we have a right to continue to develop our economy and to emit carbon emissions. And many times, I feel like every time I see my friends who are Chinese negotiators on climate change in Beijing or in other fora, I always ask them, well, what do you think? Is China ready? And it's so funny. They always demur and they always say, no, we are not leaders. We still have so much to learn from the West and from developed countries on climate change. We're just feeling like we're doing our part. And so that's what made this bombshell announcement by President Xi Jinping at the UN General Assembly so significant, because they stepped out and at a forum that's not normally, the place that you would make such a momentous announcement on climate change. And they unilaterally did it. And normally when China makes any type of announcement on climate change, it's multilaterally within a fora like the UNFCCC or with bilateral agreements like the United States, for example. And so for them to just come out and say, we're going to commit to carbon neutrality, the first developing country to do so, that was really momentous. And so I think despite what the Chinese leadership might say, I think that they are de facto the leader on climate change, especially if you look at all the other metrics by which they're leading in terms of clean energy. And so, yeah, it was really interesting to see them step out and make this really momentous statement.
That's great. You say the UN General Assembly usually isn't a forum at which these sorts of announcements are made, but it's almost become one. I feel like the UN General Assembly, because of there are so many events that are convened in that same week of the UNGA in New York, the World Economic Forum always does one. It's almost become expected. And I think that, again, this is a really good thing. Again, the kind of development that I certainly applaud. So we've been talking a little bit about competition. And this is a big focus, I think, for a lot of our thinking these days. I've seen it talked about in many venues, not the least of which, of course, is Alex's recent piece that you authored. But in his opening remarks, President Biden framed progress on climate very much in terms of competition, saying that the countries who remake their economies, who invest in a clean energy future, they're the ones who are going to, quote, win the good jobs of tomorrow and be more competitive. And he said, so let's run that race. I thought that was interesting that he framed it in terms of that. This race is a question that, I think, again, a lot of us have been thinking about, which is how necessary, in fact, is cooperation between the world's two largest emitters? I mean, can competition, in fact, be harnessed to accelerate, emissions reductions, to move major countries more quickly toward carbon neutrality? I mean, Alex, you describe a scenario of constructive competition, in which each country actually pursues national self-interest, but the net result is, significant improvement in terms of carbon emissions. And you write in that paper, the dynamics surrounding climate change are evolving in ways that support unilateral action motivated by national self-interest rather than collective action requiring alliance building. This sounds like a race to the top, a positive-sum idea that, the thing that Biden's alluding to. So let's unpack that approach a bit. Does this happen without coordination or in the absence of guardrails or constraints on competition?
Right. Yes. So there's a lot to unpack there. I think the paper that I wrote that you referenced was in some ways a reaction to the media framing on this, which was often saying, the world cannot solve climate change without U.S. and China cooperation. And then most of these articles would never really say exactly what that cooperation meant and why the cooperation piece of it was so essential. I mean, it's clear that U.S. and China action on climate change are necessary, right? Because they're collectively account for about 45% of global emissions. But the question was cooperation the key? And so, you know, what did people have in mind? You know, in part, they had in mind what Angel has already alluded to, which was the pre-Paris Agreement cooperation, which was kind of presidential joint announcements, right? And that was necessary before the Paris Agreement because you had to show that the biggest emitters were on board, and then that got everyone else on board, right? So that was necessary. But arguably, that's a little bit less essential these days now that you have the agreement, and the goal is, you know, how can you defeat the domestic opposition to climate change? And you know, there's a lot more domestic focus on implementation now. And the other thing that people might have had in mind when they talked about cooperation is the sense of a collective action or a free rider problem. You know, this goes way back. Like, the opposition in the U.S. to climate action was always often framed in terms of, well, why should we do something if large emitters like China are not doing something, right? So this was the very reason that the U.S. didn't sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. You know, almost all of the senators in the late 90s signed on and said, look, we're not going to move unless China moves, essentially, right? And so that there was the sense that, well, they were going to take advantage of us if we moved. And so what I try to raise in the piece is that the dynamics are shifting, and we're starting to think of climate action as an opportunity in a variety of ways, right? So there's the economic opportunities. We know that climate action requires dramatic transformations of energy, transportation, buildings, and all of those things are business opportunities. There's money to be made. There's innovation to be had. And so, you know, China has explicitly framed a lot of its economic policy around these types of things. Made in 2025, strategic emerging industries have included the clean tech industries because they're industries without incumbents that are kind of dominating the stage, and you can come in with a lot of support and dominate those. The U.S. is now coming somewhat late to the game. You know, I think Biden is talking industrial policy is still somewhat of a dirty word in the United States, but in essence, we're talking about a form of industrial policy, which is really just state support for things that produce good things for Americans, right? I'm a full-on supporter of those types of approaches. And so I think given these dynamics, what I talk about in the paper is just that I think there are three ways in which competition could be constructive going forward. One is those competitions over the economic opportunities of the clean tech industries. Two is competition over U.S. and China relations with other countries, right? So can you compete for alliances and support, which has much broader implications, right? Sort of votes in the UN, they are economic opportunities in themselves for the U.S. and China. And there's lots of ways in which the U.S. and China are trying to fight for the favor of other countries. And so through development aid and financing for clean tech. And yesterday, the Biden administration announced a plan on green international finance. And China has been talking about greening the Belt and Road Initiative, and we want to see more details on that.
And yeah, let's dig down on that in a second.
Yeah, and I think just to quickly mention, the third area is this kind of reputational competition, right? So this used to be kind of below the surface, but now it's very much on the surface. The leaders are sort of saying, look, we saw this at the Alaska meeting, right? In that very contentious public portion of that meeting, where the leaders were very much saying, look, the Chinese leaders said, look, we don't think that the world thinks as highly of you as you think of yourselves, right? And
right.
The U.S. is talking, Biden is talking about making democracy work again. So there is this somewhat vague and high-level competition, but I think it does matter in some ways in how aggressively the countries will push forward on this. And the positive side of it is that you could imagine these competitive dynamics helping to break through some of the blockages domestically.
Sure. But there are, you know, I have misgivings. I mean, I wonder if, Angel, you have any misgivings about this competition approach. I mean, on the one hand, it does make some sense to me, but maybe it's the best that we can hope for given the circumstances. But on the other hand, it sounds to me a bit much like, you know, kind of neoliberal fairy tale, you know, where the market will solve everything. You know, all competition is always good. I mean, I suppose the real question is, I mean, if we insist on viewing everything in this bilateral relationship as we do now through this lens of national security, are we going to be able to prevent competition with China from being framed again, you know, in terms of competition even in this? I mean, I just read Bob Menendez's press release around the Strategic Competition Act, which just, you know, came out of Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And the language he deploys is just bonkers by my lights. I mean, it makes me just worried that absent any proactive push for collaboration, that competition is just going to spill its banks immediately. It's going to become this all-consuming thing. It's going to be all about national security. China is going to be viewed as this, you know, existential threat. And I would like to see something prevent the kind of arms racing that I worry about. And that would, I mean, that's the worst thing possible, right? I mean, I've seen studies about what the defense industry does. I mean, it's not exactly a green industry, right? The thinking that underlies this whole approach to competition, it seems like it's not of that just a friendly foot race and you know, positive sum. So that's what I worry about. Angel, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Alex. I think that the framing of constructive competition, I think this is a new brand of competition that I don't think is exactly as antagonistic and dangerous and threatening as, Kaiser, what you've just articulated. I mean, so in our analysis, so I wrote a paper with Debbie Seligson, who is also a good friend of yours, and yes, she teaches at Villanova University. So in our paper for the Penn Project on the future of U.S.-China climate relations, we also had a similar argument where we said, yes, cooperation is necessary. But exactly as Alex said, I think people just take that as a given without really interrogating, well, specifically, what does that mean? And collaboration how? And collaboration on what specifically and to what aim? And so just vaguely saying, oh, we need to cooperate, I think is just, again, just empty platitudes and doesn't really get us anywhere. And we all know that this type of collaboration can be very protracted. It can be very long and arduous. I mean, just like look at the Global Framework Convention on Climate Change and how long it took to get the Paris Agreement. I think Alex and I were both in the trenches of the 2009 Copenhagen negotiations, where we saw the height of U.S. and China tensions on climate change, and they were supposed to have a new deal. We were supposed to have a new deal then, and it just got punted 60 years down the line to Paris. And so when you try to collaborate on everything, I mean, I think it's really important for process and for all these things that we need to cooperate on a global problem like climate change, but it can be very slow. So I think these things need to happen in parallel. We need to continue to have these conversations on collaboration and get really specific about what that means. But then at the same time, I think the competition element is really helpful, especially I think galvanizing action in the United States. And so what Debbie and I argue in this paper is actually we think this Green New Deal framing, which in the Chinese context, I don't think has the same type of translation and the same type of salience. So we have to think about what that actually looks like. But exactly trying to place economic recovery, economic development at the core of climate change policy. So bringing the two together. And then this is an area where we argue both sides could really collaborate and learn from each other. So for example, China already manufactures two-thirds of the world's solar photovoltaic, solar PV. And right, so this is an area where the United States, even if we wanted to jumpstart our clean energy sector and our solar PV manufacturing capacity today, it just would not be possible. And so this is an area where we simply cannot compete directly with China at this time and point.
But I feel like that's what's being sold, though. I mean, I think that what's being sold is this idea that we're going to reduplicate the entire sort of supply chain that China now kind of dominates, whether it's in photovoltaics or it's in wind turbines or in battery and storage. I mean, doesn't that redundancy, wouldn't that be just very ungreen? I mean, I understand the case for competition being able to drive positive outcomes, but maybe collaboration isn't the right word I'm looking for. Coordination, though. I mean, I worry that in the current political climate, even that kind of division of labor, this sort of ceding to China that you will manufacture the PV, you will, you know, go on, and we're just going to buy that, and then we'll be further downstream in the supply chain from you. I worry, though, that even that kind of an arrangement is politically difficult right now. Is that your sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think right now it is really difficult. And but yeah, this is kind of what I mean in terms of how we can both collaborate and compete. But yeah, so we can't create our clean energy manufacturing sector overnight. But I think for President Biden to start to put in that kind of framework and start to invest and provide the right incentives and subsidies and infusion of financial capital into that development in the United States, I think that's a good thing. And it'll help the United States become more climate resilient in the long term. But yeah, in the short term, I think we do need to recognize the reality of the situation, which is the fact that China has all this manufacturing capacity. They've directly led to driving down the cost of many of these technologies. And so they have the distinct competitive advantage. And so I think in the short term, we're going to have to work with China to source a lot of the components for us to be able to implement a lot of these technologies. But yeah, there are sticky geopolitical realities that I think that the United States is also going to have to confront. And so that's some of what we discussed yesterday in the National Committee panel. But one of the concerns that I know a lot of U.S. policymakers have is the fact that a lot of the silicate is actually produced in Xinjiang, and that's a core component of solar PV. So right. What happens? Is that an area where we can realistically collaborate right now, considering the concerns of human rights violations that the United States has in Xinjiang? And so I think that it's going to be really tricky, but that's why I think that means we need to actually become really clear about what collaboration actually means and the areas in which collaboration clearly makes sense. But I think overall, just the framing of competition is helpful in the U.S. context. And if it gets people really excited and it gets them galvanized and wanting to win or try to compete in this clean energy race, I think it will help to inspire this race to the top.
So just now we flicked at two things that I want to bring up and drill down on in a little more detail, things that I put a pin in. One was, Alex, you talked a little bit about the criticism of the carbon footprint of the Belt and Road Initiative, how Chinese money has been funding a lot of coal-fired power plants and other really carbon-intensive or environmentally destructive projects. This is one of the things. And the other is, Angel talked about a Green New Deal approach. And she talks about that a lot in her paper with Deb Seligson, who is, as she said, Deb was on the show recently. I don't know if you heard talking about something entirely unrelated, but it was great. She's brilliant. Alex, this is a dimension that you think U.S.-China competition can actually yield positive results, right? And actually, Angel, you echoed this idea on the National Committee panel yesterday. It's pretty straightforward how this would work in principle, that we offer a greener financing alternative. But how much of an appetite is there in D.C. right now for actually creating new international development programs on that scale? Do they piggyback on existing programs? Do we just sort of tweak them? And do we actually have the capacity to offer something more appealing than what China has been selling? I mean, we don't exactly have a good track record for creating good infrastructure quickly, even here at home. I mean, my wife is routinely astonished at the slow progress of every building project that she's seen here, where we live, or anywhere up and down the East Coast that we've looked at. It's just, it's kind of, astonishing. What's going to make, what do we offer besides financing? I mean, China doesn't just offer financing, right? They offer, it goes way beyond that. I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot in your question there, Kaiser. I mean,
so
I think a few aspects of this. I mean, one, there's obviously the issue of demand from developing countries. What do they want, right? So when we're talking about greening the BRI, there is a dynamic here that the local host countries are always also asking for the dirtier things. And so part of the story is a global effort to convince countries that they can develop without going the kind of pollute first and then clean up later route, right?
Right.
And there are dynamics that are changing, right? Renewable energy is just becoming much cheaper than before, right? So this idea that going to renewable energy is the more expensive option is just not true in some places, right? And so I think we have to recognize that first. And so can developing countries develop first by putting in substantial amounts of renewable energy? I think that is absolutely possible, and we need to figure out how to do this, right?
Actually, just quick shout out to your ex-colleague Barbara Fittimore. She was on this show telling me that 70% of the people in the world now live in a country where renewable energy is actually cheaper per kilowatt per
I think the more people really need to recognize that that shift. And I think, you know, part of what's going on with these outbound investments is that there's a lot of money to be made and kind of economic interests at stake in the exports, both from China and from the United States, right? So China's gotten a lot of attention for its coal exports. The United States is exporting a lot of natural gas right now, right? And so that's been an issue. You know, my colleagues at NRDC have been on this issue. And so both countries are going to have to figure out how they deal with those dynamics and shift away from that and shift money to funding renewables. But you know, the shift there is, you know, mirrors the challenges of the shift domestically, which is you have very powerful interests invested in the old ways of doing things, and you kind of have new upstarts in the cleaner industries, and you need a lot more support there to make it happen.
So do current lending institutions, are they up to the task? I mean, or do we need to create new institutions specifically for green finance?
Yeah, Angel, I don't know if you have thoughts on this. I mean, I think the existing institutions can make a lot of progress by putting bans on financing of fossil fuels, for example.
Sure.
You know, if you're going to finance anything that is not carbon free, you know, to have very strict limits on what you can finance and very strict efficiency standards and these types of things.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, Kaiser, you picked up on a really important point, which is the fact that financial institutions can be doing so much more on climate change. So a major strand of my own research is looking at the role of private sector actors and subnational actors in global climate change mitigation. And I will tell you that this is one area that has really lagged behind, which is the financial institutions. First of all, if you're a private financer, you have no obligation to release transparently information about your investments and the greenness of those portfolios and where you're investing, how many of those assets and under management are fossil-based, for example. And so that's a huge challenge. And even if you're a public development bank, either a traditional development bank or a government or a bilateral funding agency, that data is a little bit easier to come by, but still it's really difficult to get a sense of where that money is going, what kinds of projects are being financed. And so there has been, I think, relatively more analysis on this piece. But yeah, the private sector is just a huge black hole. And there have been so many calls for greater transparency. And now financial institutions are making commitments on climate change, their own private commitments, but they're not necessarily disclosing basically the what we call scope 3 or indirect emissions and emissions throughout the supply chain. And so, yeah, it's a major challenge. So, yeah, I think absolutely a lot more can be done on the financial sector piece. And it's so hard to get information and data about what they're doing and how green their investments are. And so my, I think, more skeptical sense is that not a lot is happening and a lot more can be done. Absolutely. And China has been talking since the 12th five-year plan about green finance. And we've still been waiting for more details about what exactly this means. And I think one of the first times I actually heard Xi Zhenhua speak to this particular point was at a forum last November with Europe. And somebody pushed him on this particular point of how can China claim to become carbon neutral by 2060 if they're still investing heavily in fossil-fired assets overseas and 75% of their investments overseas through their two major development banks are in fossil fuel-based assets. And so how that's fundamentally incompatible with a 1.5 degrees Celsius world. And it was the first time I heard Xi Zhenhua say, you're right, this is something that we have to address because it's just leaking carbon from China's borders overseas. And so, I mean, I think that now what can be done is pushing the Chinese government to stop exporting excess coal-fired capacity overseas and start exporting some of those green technologies, the solar, the wind, to other countries. But yeah, as Alex said, the demand has to be there. And I think as more and more countries start to submit enhanced ambition Paris pledges and they start to commit to net zero targets themselves, they're going to realize that they can't keep importing this coal-fired electricity because then they're not going to be able to meet their goals. And so I think we're starting to see some shift. And I think what's really helpful is the increased ambition of these national pledges that will necessitate adoption of more renewable energy as part of the electricity mix.
Mm-hmm. It's also worth pointing out, you know, there's a lot of skepticism about whether this kind of transformation happens. But once the economics shift in a certain way, it happens in a sense naturally, right? If you think of like what's happening in the United States, why is coal where it is right now in the United States? It's not fundamentally about the regulation, right? The regulators had to fight in the Supreme Court to say, look, our regulation isn't doing most of the work, right? Because there was arguments that it was too coercive in a sense. And what happened was just that natural gas had an advantage. And so people, you know, it didn't make sense to invest in coal. And so right now you're seeing these shifts in the renewable energy pricing. And so you can imagine this happening very quickly in a sense.
Alex, you closet neoliberal, you. Okay, so Angel, back to you. In the memorandum that you and Deb are writing, and what I've seen right now is a draft, you talk about how there's really been a shift in the U.S. away from the kind of cap and trade or even carbon tax approaches that we saw, you know, efforts to implement during the Obama administration, most notably, you know, Waxman-Markey, and more toward this Green New Deal thinking, which I'm delighted to see. You know, I mean, even, you know, moderates in the Democratic Party are very much on board with this. Your paper does, I think, a really great job in laying out why this kind of approach, which focuses, you know, on winning and on benefits more than on losing and on costs, why that would have a broader appeal. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. But you also suggest that this represents a kind of convergence with China's approach. And maybe that's not as immediately intuitive to most people, I would think. I mean, Beijing has had a much more top-down approach. You know, CO2 emissions reductions have been mandated in industrial policy, in five-year plans. So what in China's approach do you see as being similar to or at least compatible with Green New Deal thinking?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that this is part of the fundamental misunderstanding about China's environmental governance system. And so my PhD dissertation was focused on Chinese environmental governance. And whenever I would tell people either in China or the United States that I was studying this topic, they would immediately say, oh, what environmental governance? What environmental policy? And I would say, actually, they have a lot of policies in place and they are implementing them and it's really effective. I mean, China, if you look at their track record, has either met or come extremely close or even exceeded every type of climate and energy related target that it has set for itself. And not many countries can say that. And for example, China has had in place a national climate change policy since 2007, and the U.S. still doesn't have anything in place. And so I think that this is part of the fundamental misunderstanding. People think, oh, well, you have to have a neoliberal approach, right, to some type of climate policy, cap and trade, carbon taxes, and something like of that type of flavor. But in China, it has been exactly as you said, developing these top-level policies through the five-year plan and then passing those targets down to the provinces, to the cities, to the top emitting companies, and applying specific reduction targets, developing standards, for example, for efficiency, and then achieving their goals that way. And they've been incredibly effective at doing that. And so I think that that's one fundamental misunderstanding that a lot of people have about how China's governance system has worked. And so, I mean, I think you can see that there are a lot of similarities then when you look at it from that perspective with the U.S. And so, I mean, the idea that you can place industrial policy at the center and linking sector-specific climate policies with local issues, that can help to provide these direct signals to motivate industrial actors to meet climate change goals. And so that's what we really mean in terms of this Green New Deal approach that I think could have a lot of salience, as you mentioned, in both the U.S. context, and that has already had a lot of traction in China. So companies have been at the center of China's energy and climate goals. So they had the top 1,000 energy consuming enterprises program in the 12th five-year plan and the 11th five-year plan for that matter, that really focused on the top emitters and providing them infrastructure and incentives to reduce their emissions and direct targets and saying, okay, you have to reduce your emissions by this amount. And that proved to be really enormously effective. And so I think that there's a lot more similarities between the two sides and framing them along this idea of a Green New Deal and developing these winning coalitions, I think can mean that both sides, I think, are not as much as different as we think, and can really work together in really articulating what this means.
Just to add something on Angel's point, that, you know, I think there is an issue of lagging perceptions here, right? There, if you think of China 15 years ago, I think there was a very low policy priority for the environment. There was the sense of the economy kind of trumps environment. But when, if you see the transition since the 11th five-year plan, it has been a sort of pragmatic kind of environment, partially in service of environmental goals, but also in service of economic goals, right? This is to the
self-interest point about that, right?
Thinking about win-wins. And, you know, last five-year plan, you had half of the binding targets be environmental targets. It's not because China is full-on, you know, Sierra Club, right? It's in part because these are very important to disfavoring some of the heavy industries and favoring less polluting industries, right? And it was about economic policy as well.
What Angel was talking about just now reminded me of something that Jonas Nahm from Johns Hopkins, who was a co-panelist with you guys yesterday on that national committee thing, he talked about how regulatory decisions taken by one country can really reshape the entire global market in positive ways. And that's something that Angel flicked at earlier. And he gave the example of EVs, about how, you know, China's quotas and China's subsidies in that space just really lit a fire for the industry, you know, and it's really taking off now globally. Can you talk about that and how you see the future of transportation shaping up and what China's role is going to be in that?
Yeah, I mean, it's long been an argument of environmental advocates that good environmental regulation can drive sort of economic opportunities and send market signals to companies to produce in greener ways. And so what Jonas was talking about yesterday was how kind of global auto companies have kind of gone in the direction of EVs recently.
Because of China's
largely
quotas.
Because of the enormous market in China, right? So China has really been pushing this. And from the Chinese perspective, part of the calculation is that they're trying to build their own EV players. But you can see how that regulation has driven global change on this. And so I think across the board, you want to see stronger environmental regulations that create the markets for greener products. And this will be in the transportation sector. If you have renewable portfolio standards in the electricity sector, it does, you know, similarly drives the development of wind and solar and batteries and other technologies and those sorts of things.
Angel, you and Deb wrote that draft that I've seen before the election, right?
That's right.
We've had a full 3 months now of Biden. We've seen that there's not a whole ton of interest from the White House or the State Department or, you know, Justice or anyone else in kind of lowering the overall temperature with Beijing. We still have all the tariffs in place. They've, in fact, I think maybe even ratcheted things up. It's you know, even more febrile, I think, than it was. Are you inclined to want to make at this point any substantial changes to the approach that you were advocating in light of, you know, maybe the closing window on more meaningful coordination or collaboration? I mean, are you drifting toward this, hey, you know, let's compete and that can be healthy? Are you in that direction as well?
I mean, I think that what's really interesting is that you're kind of seeing President Biden adopting a Green New Deal approach, which is what we recommended. And so, I mean, he's set this very broad goal of decarbonization by 2050 for the United States, and he's focusing on specific sectors and setting targets and infusing financing and capital into them to try to galvanize action on climate change. And so a lot of the things that we recommended, so sector-specific policies saying zero emissions vehicles or zero emissions buildings, I mean, all of these things we are now seeing in the Biden plan. And so I think that that's really exciting. So, I mean, I think that it's kind of unfolding in a way that Debbie and I had anticipated. I mean, I think John Kerry, he even said before going to Shanghai to meet with Xi Jinping that he wanted to negotiate climate change in a silo. And of course, the Chinese had been saying, well, that's completely unrealistic. I mean, look at the larger geopolitical context, and that's just not possible. And we have all these other things that we want to also be able to continue conversing about with the United States. And we're not going to just only talk about climate in this vacuum. And so, I mean, I have to talk to Debbie, so I don't want to like speak too much and put words in her mouth.
No, because, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but I think you're absolutely right that you know, it's certainly moved in that direction. I'm surprised at the extent to which the new Green New Deal language has now been embraced by the administration itself. And
yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm also most excited about the focus on climate justice and focusing 40% of the funding focused on communities of color and those that have been traditionally disadvantaged. And so I think that that's really huge. And I think one of the things that the United States is going to have to also reconcile is the need for just transitions. So as the U.S. starts to decarbonize and really aggressively puts in policies to shift our electricity sector out of coal and away from natural gas, there are going to be many millions of people who will be out of jobs. And China is also undergoing a similar transition where they've been trying to consolidate and trying to shut down a lot of inefficient small coal mines, for example, and steel mills. And so there have been a lot of people also that have had to shift. And so China's been grappling with this idea of a just transition and how to do that. And I think there's a lot of lessons, too, that can be shared with the United States. And that's another area of perhaps exchange and learning and also collaboration. And so China, for example, Goldwind, which is one of the largest state-owned enterprises in China, they are now adopting a lot of the workers that have been displaced from these shutdowns in the coal and steel sectors and reskilling them to be technicians for wind turbine gearboxes, for example. And so how they're doing that, I think the U.S. also could learn a lot from. And so that's another area that I think is really encouraging about Biden's plan for climate change.
Fantastic. Hey, so one last question for to both of you, actually, before we move on to recommendations. What are we expecting from COP26 in Glasgow? I mean, China has not yet submitted its enhanced commitments. A lot of countries haven't. Can you remind listeners of what the current NDCs are and what you're hoping you'll see ahead of Glasgow?
Yeah, so for COP20, the big thing this year is what is the aggregate impact of all of the new NDCs from the country, right? They're the nationally determined contributions, essentially the plans from each country, right? Just a reminder to listeners who aren't as familiar with this, the way the Paris Agreement works is to attempt to incentivize a kind of ratchet effect. For every few years, you have a check in on to see how we're doing. This is the stock take that Angel referenced earlier in 2018, which said we're not doing particularly well. And then a few years after that, the countries are supposed to submit new plans that are more ambitious than the previous plans. And then we do another stock take. And that's how the Paris Agreement is supposed to slowly drive us towards a solution. So this year was a big year. It was supposed to be last year that the countries were going to submit all their plans. But because of COVID, we delayed it. And so this year, I think the big thing for everybody is to see, well, what are all the plans that people are putting together? And then there's going to be an assessment of, in the aggregate, where does that get us and what more needs to be done? There will be a lot of other discussions about specifics. Like, there's still details to be worked out on what role do market measures play in the global agreement. And, you've accused me of being a closet neoliberal, but I'm jokingly. Yeah, but I would say I want us to be very cautious about over-reliance on market measures in the global scheme, because there's a way that those schemes can sort of mask weakened ambition on global climate action. And so,
very good. Yeah. Angel, last word to you before we move on.
Yeah, so as of January, only less than 50 countries had actually submitted their enhanced ambition Paris pledges. And so that there's still 40 countries that haven't submitted. So COVID really did have a major impact in slowing down progress for this global stock take exercise that Alex mentioned. So the official global stock take for the Paris Agreement is in 2023. And so in advance, all the countries need to be submitting these plans so that then there can be this analysis done. And just as a reminder, in 2023, 2020, there's still a 29 to 32 gigaton gap between current policy efforts and where we need emissions to go in order to contain global temperature rise within 1.5 degrees Celsius. And we're already at 1.1 degrees above pre-industrial level. So it's not a whole lot of wiggle room before we exceed that threshold. And so that's incredibly critical. And COVID has had a major impact because countries are trying to see what their economic recovery plans are going to look like and how that's going to impact emissions. And so we saw that when China started to reopen after COVID, their emissions bounced back right to where they were pre-COVID levels and even went higher than in last year. So I think that that's really scary because that's the greatest uncertainty. We saw that there was a 7% global impact on greenhouse gas emissions due to COVID last year, and that was historic. I mean, we've never experienced that big of a drop, but we essentially need to have like a COVID-like impact on global emissions from now until 2030. And I just think that that's going to be really difficult if with economic recovery, governments then just bounce back up to pre-COVID levels. I think we'll just erase that 7% overnight. And so to me, that's going to be part of the critical discussion for COP26 and then the lead up is how can we actually have countries design these enhanced ambition Paris pledges, these NDCs that keep COVID recovery in mind and trying to build in plans that can, I think, just lock in these lower carbon or zero carbon development pathways so that we just don't go back to business as usual before COVID times.
I just want to also give a shout out to, you know, California here is on the forefront of doing this. So to imagine that this is possible, right? So you can check by app where California's electricity sector is right now. So at this moment, 66% of renewables are serving California's electricity demand, right? And so you can see it's coming from 75% of that is solar, and then you have wind. And so, you know, it's not like this is a pie in the sky that is, you know, we are making progress in certain places, and then the rest of the world, places that are farther behind, can sort of learn from places like California and other places that are ahead of the curve. And I think this is, you know, this is obviously difficult, but it's more and more feasible.
You know, I want to also shout out that Angel, your paper with Deb also really emphasizes the role of subnational and non-state actors. But we talked a little bit about non-state actors, and you were, you know, pointing the finger at some of the finance firms for not really, you know, being transparent enough about where their money is going. But you do single out for praise a lot of subnational actors, and not just California and American states, but also Chinese provinces that you've said are really taking the initiative. And this is also something that Xi Jinping singled out, you know, in his speech yesterday as well. So, you know, we're actually seeing collaboration between American states like California and Chinese provinces. Again, this is one of my sort of trying to put the best possible spin on the Trump years. Maybe I'm too optimistic here, that they actually might have felt a little more empowered and more capable just out of necessity, that they felt like they bulked up because they had to. And maybe they can continue to gain in capability and play an even more important role going forward now that things are great. I want to thank both of you so much for taking time out in what must have been a very, very busy week for you both. Let's move on to recommendations. But first, a quick reminder that the best way that you can support the work that we do here at the Seneca Podcast is to subscribe to Sup China Access, our daily email newsletter. It is just chock full of all the news you really need on China. Seneca's been going now for a little over 11 years, and we'd love to do 11 more. We definitely need you to do your part, though, so check out Sup China Access and subscribe if you aren't already doing so. On to recommendations. Angel, kick us off. What you got for us?
I just finished reading a really amazing book called Blockchain Chicken Farm and Other Stories Tech in China's Countryside by Xiaowei Wang. And it's a really great, it's like semi-ethnographic and sociological. And so it's looking at the unlikely emergence of tech in China's countryside. So how Chinese farms are now using blockchain to track chickens. And so at any time you can scan a QR code on a chicken to see where they're from and what they've eaten in their diet and all these types of things. And so, you know, a lot of my research is also looking at the role of technology and artificial intelligence and next generation data in policy. And so I really enjoyed reading her book on, these stories of tech in China's rural countryside. So that would be my recommendation.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, just my wife will get a big kick out of that because, you know, having watched this one episode of Portlandia, she jokes that, you know, what organic means is that every individual bean that you buy in that bag has a name and a history. But maybe it's true.
That's right. With blockchain, that could be a reality.
That could be. Yeah. The Internet of Things, man. It's transforming the universe, man. RFID tags on, like, everything, man. Anyway. All right, great recommendation. I Blockchain Chicken Farm has been recommended to me by other friends, and it's definitely on my list.
Well, I have a copy. I can drop it off anytime.
You can. We're so close by. I'll ride my e-bike up. I got it. Fantastic. Alex, man, what you got?
All right, so I'm going to give two quick, more wonky recommendations and one that's not at all China-related. So I've been listening to the Environment China podcast. Anders Hovey is hosting that. So it's a great little podcast with voices that you don't usually hear, and it gets into the details of on China and the environment. And I'd also recommend the Twitter feed for Yan Qin from Refinitiv. She is just really closely tracking the Chinese announcements on this from companies and from the government, and it's such a valuable Twitter feed where she's putting out the Chinese documents on this. And so if you want to follow the details of that, she has a great Twitter feed. And then
what's her Twitter handle?
It's at YANQINYQ.
Okay, so, YANQINYQ.
Yeah.
All right.
And then on reading completely not China related is that I've really enjoyed is Robert Caro's book Working on about his just stories about writing his books about Robert Moses and LBJ. Just really a pleasure to read and fascinating kind of stories from the writing life. And it's sort of inspiring to me as an academic to try to, if I could have the sort of romantic Robert Caro kind of writing life, it's something to aspire to.
Yeah, yeah. I love his LBJ stuff. I mean, it's just, I haven't actually read I just always thought of Robert Moses as the villain, you know, the anti-Jane Jacobs person, and I don't know, maybe it'd be a good reading. Anyway, Carol is just such a masterful biographer. Yeah. I'd love to read it. That's a great recommendation. I've got two. First, a serious one, which is Louis Menand's new book, The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War, which I'm just, you know, maybe eight chapters into, but it's just great. It's just, I mean, it's like the kind of book I love most. So that's going to occupy me for several weeks probably because it's really, really long. It's super rich. It's super satisfying and detailed. The other is really frivolous, but just so much fun. If you haven't seen it already, I mean, for people like, you know, Alex, you'll catch every bit of this. Angel, you're probably too young to get all of it, but it's the Spielberg movie Ready Player One, which I would have never thought to watch, but for an emphatic recommendation from one of my best friends, Drew, in Madison. His teenage son talked him into watching it, but it's actually not made for, you know, these Gen Z kids. It's actually made for Gen Xers like me, who are just immersed in nerd culture, you know, from boyhood. I mean, I got
remember the Atari 2600.
No, exactly. No, that have you seen? So you've seen it?
I've seen it. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so the Atari 2600. I mean, my favorite thing in there was that they have this magic item that they need to cast the spell to open, and the spell, and I right before they started saying it, I said, I bet it's going to be, and yes, it was, The Charm of Making from John Boorman's Excalibur, that movie. It's Anal Natrach Uthas Betu Dohel Dienve. I mean, chanted over again and over again by, you know, by Merlin in that film, and then by, you know, Morgan Le Fay or whatever. It was just, it was, I mean, me and all my, you know, nerd D&D playing friends had memorized that from the first time we saw that film back in like 81. I actually, once that happened, I was like so giddy, I had to call my brother John, who was also like a nerd like me, and just like, I can't believe it. So he started watching it, and then of course we had like this hour long conversation afterward where we just enumerated all the obscure pop culture references that only people our age and of our level of nerddom could have possibly picked up on. But it was so fun. It's so much, it exceeded my expectations so grandly. Anyway, thanks for putting me in a better mood, because this seriously, I mean, climate cooperation is one thing. And I mean, and now even believing that even a modicum of competition will be good for the planet, it's rare to come out of a conversation about the climate feeling actually kind of better.
But, that's so true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot, Kaiser. It was.
Yeah.
It was
thank fun. You.
All right, and Angel, let's catch up real soon in person.
Yeah, that would be great.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.